tonight on Arena. Yanga talks to us about her short story collection Elsewhere and Claire Munley's new play on the mythical and magical creature that is the hare. Five one double 51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Cardiff Festival in Sligo will premiere a new play called The Hare on July the 3rd and 4th. Written by Claire Munley and Bob Kelly, The Hare is the story of a young rural girl who we meet isolated by her friends living on the edge of her community. Unable to fit in, she's torn between the wildness she understands and the so-called civilised world that rejects her. The play stars Una de Vuren, with musician and composer Steve Wickham providing the music and a mysterious presence on stage. To tell me more, delighted to be joined by co-writer and director Bob Kelly, as well as performer Una de Vuren, joining us from Sligo on this Tuesday evening. Bob, talk to me a little bit about the process of coming up with this play with Claire Munley. The hare is such a wonderful, mythical and magical kind of topic. Where did the idea come from initially?
First off, how are you, Sean? Thanks for having us on. It's a pleasure. So originally, back in the day, I had adapted a piece of work by a big fantasy author named Jeff Vandermeer called Drayden in Love. And Jeff is a proponent of a literary genre which they call the New Weird, which is sort of taking root. And he edited a book of short stories, a kind of a compendium, which I think was a sort of an attempt to retrospectively define the New Weird over the last 100 years, even though it hadn't existed. And buried deep within there, I found a short story called The Salamander by Mercedes Rodoreda, which really affected me. And sometimes you come across something, it might be a song or it might be a film or something that you see or even a person you meet. And you're sort of, you feel like you've been confronted with something you haven't understood, and that maybe to try to create something in response to it is the way to go. But I sort of felt that, I mean, The Salamander has a female protagonist, and I knew what themes I sort of was interested in from that it had stirred up in me. But I felt it was very important to find a female co-writer simply because there were things to explore there that I would not have the capacity to explore, if you know what I mean. I mean, you could fake it, but it just wouldn't be what it could be. So I wanted to find a female co-writer who I felt could help me go there, and Claire was the first person I thought of.
And you talk about this it's a Catalan writer, Mercedes, I beg your pardon, Rodoreda. The salamander, is there a magical aspect to that particular creature in Catalan mythology?
Well, I think generally in mythology, salamander was regarded as a creature that was born from fire. Now, what I've read is that because it would often take shelter in the embers of a fire in dried or rotten wood. And when they threw that in the fire, then the salamander would emerge. And so the story was that it had emerged from the fire. The short story itself is about a young woman who is accused of witchcraft by her neighbours. And although she isn't one or doesn't seem to have any feelings about it one way or another, she ends up being burned as a witch, but then transforms into a salamander to escape. And what struck me as really fascinating about it was that the style it was written in, the protagonist had this power and had this unconscious magical power, but seemed to have no awareness of it, even as she was doing it or it was being done to her, had no sort of agency in this transformation she was undergoing. And I found that really fascinating.
And was it the place of the hare in Irish mythology and in Celtic mythology that attracted you as some kind of parallel here?
It's not a direct parallel. I mean, we started off kind of going that direction, myself and Claire, but when we got into the research, we found it just didn't translate because Irish people have a very different attitude to magic, and particularly magic associated with the feminine, than, say, our European neighbours or even the Protestant elements of Ireland would have had. There was a much different attitude to witches among the sort of rural Catholic Irish people. They had much more of a nuanced take on it. So we didn't really burn women at the stake here. We had much more subtle and complex ways of wrecking their lives if they were a bit different. So there wasn't a direct parallel in that for us. But we did find, as we delved deeper into folklore, the hare was something that came up for us that had a lot of resonance, for sure.
And what particular folk beliefs about the hare attracted you?
Well, I mean, the first thing that always sort of comes up is the sort of the story that pops up in lots of different forms of, you know, somebody was out and they shoot a hare, and of course then they encounter a woman who has a wounded leg, and it turns out that she was in some way this hare, and there's many variations that you come across. But I think what really resonated with us was more around folk traditions and behaviours around actual real animals rather than stories. One thing that really struck me was the story of particular hunters, and I can't remember where this was, although most of my research was on the west of Ireland. that when they caught a hare would cut the tail from the hare, and the tail was called the scut. But interestingly, scut was also a derogatory term for the female, the vulva. So you had this sort of, although I don't think they acknowledged it, there was a sort of an association with the hare as female and representing female sexuality. And it really ties into how female sexuality was feared by people in general in the past.
And this links directly, Una, into the character that you're playing, who I don't think we get her name at any point during the piece, or do we?
No, we don't. She has a secret name that I'll see if anyone figures it out. But she is unnamed. She's very closely connected to the land and to nature. Sort of on a spiritual level, I guess, because she's been left out of. She's on the fringes of sort of, as you said, sort of. Socials, the civilization, and that's where all of her sort of love and creativity and energy is filtered through, is the land and this this hare, who's her sort of companion through her life, because she doesn't have any others.
We have a sense that there's a mother in the background somewhere that needs care, or certain, and again, I don't know what elements of it are real or what elements are within the character's head, but there's an idea certainly of a mother character somewhere in the background.
Absolutely, yeah. Her mother was a big influence. You know, she sort of talks about being rooted to the spot by her mother and needing to look after her, and her mother, you know, you get a sense that it's a very contentious relationship. And even though she carries a lot of the stories forward that her mother used to tell her, and she holds a lot of those beliefs, there's not a huge connection between them as people. You know, it's very much that an obligation to look after her, yeah. I suppose.
Yeah, and she's very isolated. I mean, she's aware of her local village. The scenes bring us locations from the home to the road to the school to the bridge and to the barn. You know, these are almost, I suppose, archetypal locations in many ways. But she very much is on the land and moving through and around the land. That natural aspect of her, I suppose, is the most important characteristic, is it?
Yes, yeah. I think she's always in conflict with all the sort of modern and social norms within her world. You know, she's on this particular journey on this day, and it's left her in a kind of a vulnerable position, because she's excited and she's heading off into new possibilities. And when her heart is so open, you know, she's very open-hearted, yeah. It allows for these insecurities as she's passing by these places and the memories of things that have happened to her before to creep in. And it's always a clash with those things and trying to push forward in spite of them.
Bob, I don't know how much you'll want to tell me about the letter that arrives. I mean, there is a sense in this, it's often the case, in particularly in dramas, people would say it in novels, it's what's not said that's important here. And in some ways, it's what's not told to us in the letter that's important as much as anything else.
I think so, yeah. I mean, the letter represents to her, it represents hope and the possibility of a better life. I think something that myself and Claire talked a lot about, tying into, is people we'd known in our lives or been aware of who found themselves on the edge of society, whether it was in school or afterwards, and never managed to find their way in. And that sense of responsibility you feel, or complicity somehow, that maybe if you had been nicer or somebody else had been nicer, and not all of them make it, you know. And so I think that where you might want this character to find her way to having friends and doing the leave and cert and meeting somebody and settling down and having a nice life where she gets sort of incorporated into society, I think for her, the letter that arrives is maybe hope of something more of a miracle, that something that she might not have to compromise her sense of self, that there might be a world where she can actually be. Because she also has rejected society because it simply doesn't have, it won't accept her as she is.
Yeah.
And so the letter, I think, represents a hope for her of a better life.
It's not just that her friends are nasty to her, but she kind of keeps herself quite separate and is quite an observer of stuff going on within the community as well. And I think that might feed into the section that you're going to perform for us, a little section from the play, Una. what kind of context do we need for where we are in this particular part? Quite close to the beginning, am I right in thinking that?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So she's sort of setting off on her journey and is sort of orientating us in her world and some of the local folklore and things that she comes in contact with on the journey she's heading on.
All right, let's have a listen then.
Lovely. Look out over that bay. The sea is at war, toiling at itself, turning itself over and the clouds making ready. Smell that storm that won't be long following. No waves, only fierce confusion. We're on the high ground here, coming down towards the rest of them. I do come into school from the coast like a bad cloud. Rocky fields and rushes, Scotland, ring forts and cairns and broken walls, what have you. I go where I like. I do often find bones. Out the other way, you can sense without seeing where the path leads down. Away to the road that leads to the river, that leads to the bridge. Past them ruined walls, ruined houses, that ruined school with all them awful people in it. And the land between us, full of things nobody understands. I've always been in this place, and Mammy's told me all the Christians won't tell. She told me about the walking tree and the tunnel that leads from the bad ring fort to the abbey. She told me about the crooked fella used to live out by the rocks and only came in when he was sick. Told me about Father Byrne, who was closer to the devil than he was to God, if you believe in that sort of thing. God, I mean. And about Maggie Clifford's baby girl that was born with the heart of a bird instead of a child's heart. And how all the sparrows gathered round the house when she was dying. Mammy knew the child was gone because of the way they did all lift off together.
And there, that was Unini Vrain there performing from the play The Hare, co-written by Bob Kelly and Claire Munley, and Bob Kelly and Unini Vrain joining us from Sligo this evening. And you get a real sense, Bob, from that performance from Una of that this is a very powerful young woman, despite that isolation that she has from her community and from her friends. She knows exactly who she is and what she wants.
I think so. And I think what's interesting about the mythology that she orients it in is that it's not a communal mythology. It's almost, these are private mad stories told to her by her mother about this place. She's not walking around going, there's Jimmer and Gráinne's cave. She has her own personal language. She has her own names for the plants she encounters because she didn't learn these things in school with everybody else. She's had to kind of create her own world and her own language. And there's a strength in that, I think. There's a sort of an integrity of self that often people who grow up very isolated, particularly in rural places, can have. It can be very difficult for them to interface. I mean, I grew up in a very, very rural place as well, so I've seen it a little bit. As I say, did you? You know,
yeah, me too. I grew up exactly the kind of place that we're describing here in the show.
Yeah, and it can be difficult then when you come into the town, for want of a better word, or you come into the secondary school and suddenly you've got all these kids who know an awful lot more than you, to for your own private little world to interface with a bigger one. And that can be tricky for people.
But
in this case,
they know
her strength of character, I think, that we're trying to communicate
across. In her case too, it might be the kids in the local secondary school who think they know an awful lot more about her. Tell me a little bit, if you would, about the role of the composer and musician Steve Wickham on the stage for this, Bob.
Well, Steve is somebody I've collaborated before in the past. He did music for one of my a play reading a few years ago down the docks that had a lot of sea shanties in it. So he was our first port of call for this. And I knew that with Steve, you get an awful lot more than you bargain for. If you just think I'll add a musician into this, and that'll be helpful. Steve is a real presence on the stage. He loves theatre. He's a musician, obviously best known as a musician, but he always maintains that theatre is his favourite art form. And the first thing he always says to me whenever we work together is this: I'm not going to be sitting off in the corner playing the fiddle. I'm not going to be doing music during the transitions. I want the music to be a part of this. And not in a forceful way. He also maintains that he doesn't want it to be more than it has to be either, but he needs it to be integral. And so what happens when you get Steve in the room is that you have... you know, you have a very interesting and powerful presence in the room. Somebody who's multi-talented because he's a multi-instrumentalist. He has a very gentle air about him, and he has a very wonderful nature for collaboration. So, I mean, it's been great. His role there on the stage, it started off just as a musician who's there to support the performer back in the early days. But very quickly, because it's Steve and because he has such a lovely presence, you kind of say, okay, we have to feed this guy in somehow and make him an integral part
of it. And how does that affect? Because on the page, in terms of the text, Una, this is a one-person show. But the presence of Steve there, what has that brought to the production for you and the realisation of the character for you?
Oh, it's wonderful. Steve's an absolute gem. It's he really understands the piece, and he has his own understanding of it that he's very passionate about, and he's really helping. Like, it's first of all lovely just to have somebody else
there to
sort of, yeah, exactly. And especially at the beginning, we're very much companions, and you know, she sometimes gets a bit lost, but she finds him again, and like, it's that thing of he is able to help convey some of the subconscious emotion alongside, and I'm actually able to counter it with everything is fine, it's all grand. And then, you know, Steve is able to be there. I think you were describing it today, Bob, is like, he's like a really good friend who's like, are you sure? You sure it's all right? I don't know.
And I suppose the other side of it is, you mean, there is another worldly side to this, and in some ways music is another world from the words that you are performing as the character. The two worlds are kind of rubbing up against beside each other in that way.
Brings a lot of magic.
Yeah, it has that quality for sure. Thanks so much to both of you for coming in to speak to us this evening. That's Unani Vrain and Bob Kelly. The Hair by Bob Kelly and Claire Munley, and starring Unani Vrain and Steve Wickham, will be at the Carja Festival in Sligo, July the 3rd and 4th, at the Factory Performance Space in Sligo. More information from carjafestival.com. And the show will go then on to the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary and to the Cork Arts Centre. That said, The Hair, the title of the piece. And on the basis of that, you'd have to say that CMAT may well have done it again. That is a track called Have Fun from her second album, which is called Crazy Mad For Me. It's due out in October. First album was such a success for her, and big touring schedule this summer, including the Isle of Wight and Glastonbury festivals, as well as the headline tour of the UK and Ireland later in the year. But there we had it, the first single from her second album, a track called Have Fun. Now, very excited that tomorrow night I will be speaking with Wes Anderson, director of films including The Grand Budapest Hotel, The Royal Tenenbaums, and of course Fantastic Mr. Fox. He will be talking to us about his latest star-studded film, Asteroid City. Saw it the other morning and my brain is still spinning around, working out or trying to work out what was going on, but it really is a star-studded affair. And to give you a flavour, let's listen to a scene which features Jason Schwartzman as Augie Steenbeck, a photographer, and Scarlett Johansson as a very glamorous actress called Mitch Campbell.
He took a picture of me.
Uh-huh.
Why?
I'm a photographer.
You didn't ask permission.
I never ask permission.
Why not?
Because I work in trenches, battlefields, and combat zones.
Really?
Uh-huh.
You mean you're a war photographer?
Mostly. Sometimes I cover sporting events. My name is Augie Steenbeck.
Mm-hmm. What are you going to do with that picture?
Well, if it's any good, I guess I'll try to sell it to a magazine, now that you mention it. Midge Campbell, eating a waffle.
There you go. Jason Schwartzman as Augie Steenbeck, Scarlett Johansson as Mitch Campbell in a scene from Asteroid City. The latest offering from director Wes Anderson, who I will be speaking to tomorrow. Really looking forward to that interview. Novelist and short story writer Jan Gehe has won numerous awards for fiction, including the prestigious Mao Dun Literature Prize, and was named by People's Literature magazine as one of 20 future literature masters in China. She has an MFA in creative writing from the University of East Anglia, where she was the recipient of the UEA, that's University of East Anglia, International Award. Elsewhere, in his is her English language debut collection of 9 short stories, which range from contemporary Ireland to ancient China, exploring all sorts of ideas, including isolation, loss, language, and this whole idea of liminality, which I guess, Jan, I'm delighted to have you with us this evening. I guess elsewhere, kind of already in the title of the collection of short stories, you're looking at that kind of in-between liminal space. Was that on your mind at the point of writing these stories?
Hello, hi, thank you for having me. Yeah, I suppose when I was working on this story, I think I really was kind of like at last, but probably that was the best place for a writer to be when you begin to work on a project. I think I did not know where I was going as an English writer. As you were saying, you know, I was starting kind of to try to find my voice in this new language. And so I was kind of probably, I noticed myself while I was working through this collection, I was constantly hopping in between places, you know, sometimes like a Western, like an Anglophone sphere, and then sometimes back in China, back in ancient China. And so it was kind of difficult for me when I actually finished the collection, finished all the stories, and it was initially titled 9 Stories when I sent this to my agent, and to find like a title that's fitful for those 9 stories who are like vastly different. And in the end, I think Elsewhere is this notion that really encapsulates this duality of it's either Elsewhere to readers here, or when it's here to readers here, sorry for this, but it's like Elsewhere to the characters in the story quite often. So it's kind of like, it depends on who's standing at what place and looking towards which direction that defines where is Elsewhere to each individual. I think, yeah, that's something.
Yeah, and you could, I don't know whether there's a word for other language, but other language is very important here as well, in that maybe you would explain, this is your first publication, your first writing of fiction in the English language. Would you explain your own relationship to English and your own relationship to the Chinese language?
Well, Chinese is my native language, so I was born into it. It wasn't even much of a choice, right? But like, as people say, you know, it's my mother tongue. So it's very intimate for me, but at the same time, I think having been working in Chinese for so many years, and there was like certain, maybe like a baggage, mainly probably like it shows in the way of how I see myself as a writer in this language, where I think I should go. You have all the things you wanted to achieve because you've been working in this language for so many years. And I think English, you know, is my second language. To me, it's like all fresh. And like initially, I think when I kind of maybe stumbled into wanting to write a story in English, it was like this decision was kind of quite a quick decision. I wasn't really thinking about it too much, but then it was this sensation of like going into a new room and I could just get to vandalize in a way that there was no rules for myself. You know, I was like a new writer in this language. So I didn't want to achieve anything. I was just like having fun with it. And that great sensation of maybe like a new freedom, like founding this different language. And I think it was very thrilling to me.
Did you find yourself suddenly writing about perhaps themes that you couldn't approach in your mother tongue in Chinese? Or were there things that jumped out at you in English that just weren't present when you were writing in Chinese?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I didn't realize that until like much later, until kind of had been kind of working this language for maybe like a year and two. And then suddenly I think I went through this stage where I wanted to write some stories, mainly because I became a mom when I was kind of happened simultaneously, me becoming a mother and me starting to write in English. And I kind of wanted to write something about, you know, my experience as a mom, like motherhood. And then I realized English was like, or in the sense of a second language, is the perfect tool for me to depicting such experiences. Because I think every language, maybe not just Chinese, but like, you know, your native language or a language is quite often constructed under a patriarchal structure. So that's the structure. And then when you're using this language, you feel this gaze of like patriarchal gaze, isn't it? And I think it's very hard for a woman writer to navigate in such a language, kind of having to feel all those societal and cultural burden that's embedded in the language, and to write about, see, like a female body or a bodily experience for a woman, or the experience of breastfeeding, etc., and without having this overt sense of maybe like a stigma, but it's really kind of, you know, kind of handed to you by the society, by the language. I think by using English in the sense of the second language, that gives me this aesthetic distance for me to rid myself of this stigma of like, you know, being in a woman's body, writing about a woman's body, etc. And that gives me great freedom in working on those subject matters.
Yes, you mentioned motherhood there. You've already mentioned, and one of the stories, in fact, is called Mother Tongue, and language is very important in the stories. Your own mother died when you were quite, I think you were in your late teens. Were you 19 when she died? Was that a topic that you had approached or written about in Chinese?
No, not really. Yeah. So again, like, this is one of the things that surprisingly, and you kind of found this space, like mental space or maybe creative space simultaneously. And in this language where again, it doesn't, everything just does not feel as visceral as it is in your native language, in your mother tongue. And in this sense, in the story titled Mother Tongue in this collection, was me, like, for the first time trying to write about, kind of like staring at it squarely, writing about my experience, how it is like for somebody to lose their mother and the aftermath of it. You know, it kind of lasts for years, like decades. But I wouldn't have been able to kind of write that had I been trying to write that story in Chinese. Yeah.
It is interesting because there is one story, and I won't get into the specifics of where it happens, but there's this almost this howl from the character, or a cry where she literally cries out to her mother, and it really struck me that it was as if it something freed up you as a writer via this character and via this narrator to make that cry.
Yeah, and then the naming of mother is also, I'm sure that's probably one of the few words that's just the same regardless of the language, you know. So in Chinese, mother is mama. Yeah. And then in this particular sense, and this character had been carrying on her life like solely in English. She had moved to Dublin. She had a husband who was Irish. So she's been, you know, immersed in English and English only. But that was the point for her to kind of just kind of having her previous life kind of thrusted into this life, and she's pretending that everything is okay in the form of this singular word like mama. But then, like, I think it doesn't require explanation from, you know, as the author, because everybody knows what it is. That's the universal word.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose it is a direct reference to the mammary glands and to that process of feeding as a child. I guess that's why that mama sound is so universal. In fact, shooting an elephant, you touched on it there about the character of Shan Shan and her Irish husband, Declan. What brought you to Ireland?
Wow, my Irish husband. Who's not Declan, whose name is not Declan.
Yes, of course.
Yeah, so, yeah, I kind of met my husband, Daniel. And, yeah, we met in China. And then I was about to go back to the States. He was about to come back to Ireland. We just wanted to be together. And so I think he persuaded me. He basically said something to, like, along the line of, like, moving to Ireland would make me a better writer, he thinks, because this is very unique. Like, United States is kind of in a way, because I lived there before. And he says, you know, maybe to have some new experience would be really good for you and as a writer. And I was like, yes, I'm sold. So that's how we moved to Dublin in 2015, actually. Yeah.
So while there are parallels in the situation, it isn't autobiographical in that respect, although I'm sure it touches on some of your own experiences. Would you read a part of Shooting an Elephant for us, Jan? Maybe you'd give us a little bit of context before you read this section.
Yeah, of course. So I'm just going to read this tiny bit of Shan Shan, the character. She was in the Londis by the quay, and then she's just having a conversation with the cashier. So then... here we go. The cashier grinned and rolled up his short sleeve to show her a fist-sized tattoo stretching on his upper left arm. Can you check this for me? I told the artist I wanted the word for home. Does it look right to you? Shan Shan then recognized the black curlicues. John. Oh no, she gasped slightly. Behind her, a man queued with a full basket. Just one second, the cashier said to the man before asking Shan Shan. Is it not right? He checked his biceps. Shan Shan said, this is not the character for home. It means grave. You're kidding me. Shan Shan glanced back at the uncomplaining customer. It should be easy to get it fixed, she said to the cashier quickly. You just need to move the dot in the middle to the top of the counter, and then it's home. Do you want me to write it down for you? The cashier thought about it for a few seconds. Oh, never mind, he said. I'll keep it as it is. Grave is grand.
Grave is grand, and you clearly that's that's Jan reading from her story, shooting it out and part of her new collection elsewhere. Clearly, in the process of writing for the first time in English, you picked up a lot of Hiberno-English terms along the way. I presume that was from your time here in Ireland, Jan. Grave is grand. Grand's a grand grave Irish word.
Yeah. I mean, when I first moved from Ireland to England for mainly the MFA program, people often commented that I had a very strong Irish accent. I don't know if I still have it now, but I do have loads of expressions that later came out in the copy editing process. They were like, oh, so what is this? And I think I can't remember if I changed it or not, but in one of the stories, again, took place in Dublin, and I have this thing of this guy looking through the press, and then I think they were like, what is press? And so then they asked me to change it to cupboard. I think I don't know if I changed it, but I kind of resisted thinking, but it's true to the character, because yes, this guy is Irish and it's like in Ireland, so it's like it's natural for him to call it press. But I got some question to say, why are you using this?
Yes, then there are a couple of other Irish expressions in there, some of which I can't repeat on air, but you really did get some of the colloquialisms very well indeed. There is a section in Shooting an Elephant as well, and this comes across in other stories too, where perhaps the Chinese language is used by people, in this case in Ireland, as a kind of a taunt, or certainly is it an exoticization of the character of Shan Shan in some ways? Maybe you talk to me a little bit about your own experience of how the language was used. I don't know if against you is too strong a word.
Yeah. And I think obviously this is something I don't really know if it's too weird for other people to hear, like, because I think I've talked about it with other kind of Asian people, like living in this part of the world or in the US, and we all feel like being shouted ni hao, which is Chinese hello, by like a random stranger is quite like abrasive. And then it's obviously like ostensibly you kind of feel, oh, this is somebody trying to say hello to you, like in your native language. Shouldn't you feel like be grateful or something? But I think the problem with people shouting at like a seemingly East Asian person who's not necessarily Chinese, ni hao, is that it doesn't like invite the other person to come to engage in the conversation. It's kind of like ni hao, it's like a brick that kind of they throw it out and it hits you and it kind of like pins out your foreignness. And that's all it does. Because this ni hao quite often is kind of like, you know, in the way of like a yell. It does not really like have any follow-up to say, shall we talk about anything? So kind of feel in that sense, it feels quite abrasive, feels quite, yeah, sometimes I don't know if those feelings were like quite justified. In the sense, if somebody shouts ni hao to me, I feel quite kind of offended, slightly, kind of, at least I cringe a little bit, but I don't know if that's like, but at the same time, I think anything, you know, like in Ireland, people often say, where are you from? Because we like, you know, we ask each other, where are you from? And I think if people ask me in Dublin, say, where are you from? I personally, I was never offended because it's always like a great conversation starter. They say, where are you from? And then we begin to talk. And I think anything that invites a conversation is a good thing. But anything that kind of rejects, kind of just circles out your foreignness and then ends the conversation is just a gesture of shouting ni hao. And that's kind of a bit aggressive.
Absolutely. And I suppose, and I'm sure when you say where you're from and you say China, I have a cousin working in China is probably the next phrase that you often heard, and you're expected to have met the cousin, I would guess, as well. I haven't got a chance to ask you about your stand-up comedy routine. I saw a wonderful interview with you and Maeve Higgins where I know that stand-up comedy was one of your desires, but you've stuck with the literature, and I think that is probably serving you more than adequately. Jan, thanks for being with us this evening.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
That's Jan Ge, and Jan was speaking to us about her short story collection, Elsewhere, which is published by Faber. Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Richard Ford is in Ireland at the moment, and he has recorded some readings for us here on Arena from Be Mine, which is his latest novel. Be Mine is the fifth and final in Richard Ford's Frank Bascom series. Here's an early passage from the novel.
Lately, I've begun to think more than I used to about happiness. This is not an idle consideration at any time in life, but it is a high-dollar bonus topic for me, born 1945, approaching my stipulated biblical allotment. Being an historical Presbyterian, not attending, not believing like most Presbyterians, I've passed easily through life observing a version of happiness old Knox himself might have approved, walking the fine line between the twinned injunctions that say, whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger, and happiness is whatever is not bludgeoning unhappiness, the second being more Augustinian, though all these complex systems get you to the same mystery. Do what now? This median path has worked fairly well through most situations life has flung my way. A gradual, sometimes unnoticed succession through time without anything great happening, though nothing unsurvivable, and most of it quite okay. The grievous death of my first son, I have one other. Divorced twice. I've had cancer. My parents have died. My first wife has also died. I've been shot in the chest with an AR-15 and nearly died myself, but probably didn't. I've lived through hurricanes and what some might say was depression. It was mild, if it was depression at all. Nothing, however, has sent me spiraling to the bottom, so that cashing in my own chips seemed like a good idea. Much quite good contemporary literature, which I read in bed, and if I angle the page right, is all about just such matters, with happiness ever elusive, but still the goal. And yet, I'm not sure if happiness is the most important state for us all to aspire to. There are statistics on these subjects, graduate degrees, fields of study offering grants, a think tank at UCLA. Happiness apparently declines in most adults through their 30s and 40s, bottoming out in the early 50s, then sometimes starting up again in the 70s, though it's not a sure thing. Knowing what you fear in life may be a more useful measure and skill set. When asked by an interviewer, do you feel you could have been happier in life, the poet Larkin said, no, not without being someone else. Thus, purely on average, I would say I've been happy. Happy enough, at least, to be Frank Bascom and not someone else. And until late days, that has been more than satisfactory for getting along. Recently, however, since my surviving son, Paul Bascom, who's 47, became sick and presenting well-distinguished symptoms of ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, though there's speculation the Iron Horse really didn't have it but had something else, the subject of happiness has required more of my attention.
And that was Richard Ford reading from his latest novel, Be Mine. Richard is taking part in a number of literary events around the country over the next few weeks. On the 25th of June, he'll be in Kells for the Hinterland Festival. Hinterland.ie for updates on that and everything happening at that festival. And he will be in Kenny's Bookshop in Galway on June the 30th. Kenny's.ie will give you all of the information there. In 2012, violinist Eloise Flair-Thom and cellist Max Ruisi founded the 12 Ensemble, a core formation of 12 of London's leading chamber musicians with the objective of performing and presenting diverse music of the highest quality. The ensemble quickly developed a reputation as one of Europe's most dynamic collectives, combining a repertoire of core classical pieces as well as new commissions and creative collaborations across a broad range. Tomorrow night, as part of Cork Midsummer Festival, the 12 Ensemble will play the Cork Opera House. On the bill is Vivaldi's Four Seasons, not the original score by Vivaldi himself, but rather Max Richter's recomposed Four Seasons. To be delighted to be joined on the line this evening by Eloise Flair-Thom. Maybe just a little bit about the 12 Ensemble. First of all, Why the number 12? I've always wanted to know how yourself and Max decided on that. You know, the string quartet, the string quintet, the sextet. I haven't. Are there any, whatever you say, for a 12-tet?
Well, the reason why we decided on 12 as the kind of core number is that's kind of the smallest amount of strings you can have to play most larger string orchestral repertoire and kind of do it justice. So we decided on 12, but we're actually often more than 12 these days.
12 is the core group. And you work, and I presume even when there's a larger ensemble, do you work for the most part without a conductor, which involves that kind of close listening and close communication with each other that you don't necessarily have if there's a conductor there?
Yes, exactly. We find it a very exciting way to work and perform because, you know, each of the instrumentalists has kind of the power of artistic decisions in their hands. So you communicate a lot more on stage, and I think it really delivers to the audience.
12 chefs, though, that's a lot of hands going into the pot, isn't it?
It is. We try and be as democratic as possible, but yeah.
So lots of different flavours are allowed to go into the dishes.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm interested in why you wanted to take on Max Richter's recomposed version of The Four Seasons. Maybe you'd explain what, for you, Max Richter has done to that original Vivaldi score.
Yes, of course. So Vivaldi's original Four Seasons is an iconic work. For solo violin and strings and harpsichord. And Max Richter has reimagined this work by taking rhythmic or melodic elements of each movement of the seasons and looping them, phasing them, and kind of turning their work into a post-minimalist reimagination in his own language. So it's very exciting to play. It has elements of the original, but also these beautiful soundscapes that, yeah, that's very special.
Can I listen to a little bit of Spring, actually? I particularly like this movement, and I think it's Daniel Hope who's the violinist. This is a famous recording, the Deutsche Grammophon recording of the Max Richter score, which I think is the only recording out there at the moment. But let's have a listen to a little bit of Spring, where your instrument, the violin, they are violin concertos, but the violin is very much to the fore here.
Yes.
That's part of Spring 3, in fact, the movement from Max Richter's Vivaldi's Four Seasons Recomposed. It will be played tomorrow night in the Cork Opera House by the 12 Ensemble, and Eloise Flair, Tom of the Ensemble, is speaking with me this evening. In many ways, Eloise, that piece is very close to the original Vivaldi, but yet somehow he manages to shift it into a slightly more contemporary mode. Do you have to get very technical to explain to us how that has happened? What has he done that makes it sound so modern?
Well, he's taken, so the solo violin line, he's taken a few bars from the original and he loops the 8-bar phrase. So already that's changing, whereas the Vivaldi kind of automatically develops into something different altogether. So you feel like there's more of a kind of pulsing rhythm that keeps going. And then he uses a gliding violin melody under like the texture, which still sounds like Vivaldi, but then has this like glorious, I guess, more modern violin melody.
I suppose in some ways, when you talk about, I think you said when you were describing what he has done, what Max Richter has done, you said he kind of brings elements of minimalism into it, and people will know Philip Glass, they'll know that sound, and they'll know that repeated quality. So really what Richter has done there is he's taken one of Vivaldi's little phrases and done a Philip Glass on it in some ways, hasn't he?
Well, yeah, I guess with the minimalism. But I think he also uses electronics and slightly different things to keep it in his own voice. I think.
Yeah, let's have a listen to Summer 2, where I think this is he refers to the movement simply as Summer 1, 2 and 3, and Spring, yes. Spring is the only one that has a kind of an extra one. There's Spring Zero, which is a little introduction. But let's have a listen to Summer 2, and you've mentioned the electronics there. I think they're very much present in this movement. Let's have a listen. A little flavour there of Summer 2 from Max Richter's Vivaldi's Four Seasons Recomposed. As I was saying, it'll be played by the 12 Ensemble in the Cork Opera House tomorrow night as part of the Cork Midsummer Festival, with Eloise Flair-Tom playing that solo violin part that we heard there. But at the beginning of that section, Eloise, I'm not sure if it was electronics or whether part of that kind of eerie effect that is achieved can actually be achieved with harmonics and using your bow and your fingers on the strings in a slightly different way from the traditional style of playing.
Yes, exactly. So it's very high violin harmonics that are kind of held as a texture throughout the work, and it creates this very unusual glistening kind of sound.
It almost strikes me in even in traditional interpretations of Vivaldi's Four Seasons, the summers mustn't have been great in Vivaldi's day. It's quite a dark concerto, really, the summer section, isn't it? Darker than one might expect.
Yeah, exactly. It's not the summer that we all like to think of, you know, school holidays and having a great time. It's more stormy, I guess a Mediterranean summer.
Yeah, there's a touch of that, and the thunderstorm is certainly part of the summer section. What do you do then for the parts of the Richter score that do demand electronics and do demand more of that style of thing? How do you treat those, Eloise?
Well, there are two versions of the piece. So when you perform with Max Richter, he has all the electronics set up, and he's also created a concert piece that's acoustic, which is what we'll be playing. So you've got harpsichord, harp, and strings, and some of the sounds are, you recreate the kind of electronic texture acoustically.
Yeah, so he has scored it for both possibilities, and it is that more acoustic style of thing that you'll be working on tomorrow night. I see also that you'll be playing scores like Power of the Dog, which is on Nick Cave's latest album Carnage, and lots of other material in there as well. Thanks for being with us this evening, Eloise. That's Eloise Flair-Tom, who along with the 12 Ensemble will play Cork's Opera House as part of the Midsummer Festival. Corkmidsummer.com for full detail. Now, just to remind you, the Galway International Arts Festival, July 17th through until the 30th, we'll be broadcasting two shows from Galway on Thursday the 20th and Friday the 21st of July. But the second week of the festival, we're going back down to Galway for a very special event, Thursday the 27th of July, in fact, an audience with Druid Theatre. We'll be talking the three plays of Sean O'Casey's Dublin Trilogy, The Plough and the Stars, The Shadow of a Gunman, Juno and the Paycock, will be performed as the Druid O'Casey epic theatrical event, one really have to say. It heads out on a national tour and an international tour after its time in Galway. And at 3 p.m. on the 27th, we will be talking with the creative team behind Druid O'Casey, director Gary Hines, cast of the three plays, Catherine Walsh, Marty Ray, Rory Nolan, Hilda Fay, Zara Devlin and more. We'll be finding all about their approach to these classic pieces of Irish theatre, and obviously the resonances of those O'Casey plays in contemporary Ireland. That's a special arena, Druid O'Casey, from the Town Hall Theatre in Galway, Thursday, July the 27th, 3 until 4 p.m. You can be part of it, but you're going to have to go and book your ticket on druid.ie if you want to be there. That is our lot for this Tuesday evening. Leah Murphy researched, Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator, Mark McGrath was in sound this evening, and tonight's programme produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.